I have looked upon the community of Latter-day Saints in a vision and beheld them organized as one great family of heaven, each person performing his several duties in his line of industry, working for the good of the whole more than for individual aggrandizement. And in this I have beheld the most beautiful order that the mind of man can contemplate, and the grandest results for the upbuilding of the kingdom of God and the spread of righteousness upon the earth. Why can we not so live in this world? Brigham Young's sermon of January 12, 1868, eloquently underscores the importance of the concept of the family in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. The family has been an important topic of theological concern in nearly all religions, but few groups have placed such extraordinary emphasis on the family as have the Mormons. Like many other groups, the Latter-day Saints have seen the family as the basic building block of social order, as well as the model for larger institutions such as church and government. Yet the Mormons have gone farther than have most other religious movements in seeing the family not merely as the basis of social order in this life, but also as the foundation for all growth and development in the afterlife as well. In a very fundamental sense, Mormonism is not simply concerned with the family, as are so many other groups. The Mormon religion, in the last analysis, could be said to be really about the family. The church is conceived as the family writ large, with both the strengths and weaknesses that such an emphasis entails. How and why did such a great emphasis on the family develop in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints? What were the intellectual and social roots of such beliefs? And how were Mormon concerns related to those of other religious groups of their period? And what were some of the strengths and weaknesses of the Mormon preoccupation with the family as the basis for both religious and social order? These are complex and difficult questions, and several caveats are in order. As neither a Mormon nor a professional theologian, my reflections today constitute only a preliminary attempt to identify and explore some of the most important Latter-day Saint concerns about the relationship between the family and the church. After nearly a decade of studying the Mormon family, particularly the development of plural and celestial marriage in the 19th century, I am well aware of the extraordinary richness of this topic and the impossibility of doing it full justice in such a short time. Others will have to further test and refine the hypotheses presented here. In addition, since my personal interests are largely those of a social historian rather than a theologian, my major concern will be to relate Mormon theological concepts of the family to the social context in which those beliefs developed and had their appeal. I believe that this approach is quite compatible with that of the Latter-day Saints, which characteristically is less interested in abstract ideas per se and more concerned with the social consequences of those ideas. This pragmatic orientation was lucidly expressed in the Millennial Star in 1852 in a statement probably written by Orson Pratt. He declared, "One of the principal faults in the religions of men is this: they do not reach the social condition nor meet the needs of the human family. Indeed, it is the boast of many religious teachers that their religions are not of this world. The chief excellence of the religion of heaven consists in this, that it meets the needs of man in every condition in which he may be placed, morally, socially, physically, temporally, or spiritually. It blesses him according to his capacity, both in this world and in the worlds to come. Time does not comprehend eternity, but eternity comprehends time." Following such an approach, this paper will therefore pay close attention to the relationship between theological beliefs and the social and intellectual context in which they arose. To understand the development of Mormon theological approaches to the family, one must first understand the basic concerns of the Latter-day Saint religious movement as a whole. Western New York State, where Joseph Smith grew up and founded the Mormon Church in 1830, was an area that was experiencing rapid economic growth, unstable social conditions, and sharply conflicting religious movements during the antebellum period. Much as California today serves as both a source and magnet for all manner of religious and social causes, Western New York in the early 19th century was repeatedly burned over by the fires of religious revivalism and by crusades to transform society. Joseph Smith, a poor and uneducated but precocious and sensitive young man, was deeply disturbed by the cacophony of ideas and causes that surrounded him. How was he or anyone else to know what was really true, he asked. Eventually, Smith reached the conclusion that all existing religions were wrong and that God had specially called him to set up a new religious and social synthesis, both for himself and for others. Through what he described as the translation of a set of golden plates and a series of revelations from God, he began to create a set of beliefs and a religious organization that he conceived as a restoration of early Christianity and a synthesis of all previously valid human truth. Quite an order. The new faith, he believed, ultimately would usher in a millennium of earthly peace and harmony, the kingdom of heaven on earth. If Smith was concerned about the religious disorder in the burned over district, he must also have been disturbed by the disruption of family, life, marriage, and sex roles in the area. Western New York was a hotbed of competing sexual attitudes and experiments, ranging on the one extreme from the celibacy of the Shakers to the other extreme of promiscuous sexual activities that came to be known by the pejorative catch-all term, spiritual wifery. Joseph Smith was an active and inquisitive young man who was coming of age himself. It is thus surely no accident that concerns for a restoration of proper family ties was implicit in the commission Smith said had been given him in his vision of September 21, 1823, when, according to his account, the angel Moroni told him that he would eventually bring forth the Book of Mormon. It was said then that Elijah would restore to Joseph Smith the priesthood powers of the true church before the second coming. And he shall plant in the hearts of the children the promises made to the fathers, and the hearts of the children shall turn to their fathers. If it were not so, the whole earth would be utterly wasted at his coming. The Book of Mormon itself similarly included discussions of the fornication and lasciviousness and every kind of sin that were running rampant in its time. Such excesses and the family disharmony with which they were associated were denounced in no uncertain terms, although no detailed blueprints for overcoming such problems were offered. It was one thing to be disturbed by the family disorder in Western New York during the antebellum years, and quite another to do something about it. In attempting to develop principles upon which order could be reestablished in family relations as well as in religious life, Smith could draw on many sources. One of the most important of these undoubtedly came from his New England heritage. In many respects, Mormonism was, as Emerson described it, an afterclap of Puritanism, both in its approach to religion and the family. The Puritans who emigrated to Massachusetts were attempting to overcome the religious and social disorder they had experienced in England by creating a cohesive new Bible commonwealth in which the good of the community would take precedence over individual self-interest. The family, for them, served as a model for other social institutions, with its hierarchical relations between husband and wife, parents and children, fitting into a larger hierarchy of relationships extending up to God. The Puritans strongly opposed fornication and adultery, as well as other less common sexual transgressions. Yet given their Calvinistic belief in the innate depravity of human nature, Puritans anticipated that lapses from ideal standards would occur. They therefore took careful and realistic steps to restrain such behavior as much as possible. On the other hand, and contrary to the popular stereotype, the Puritans were certainly not sexual prudes. They held very positive attitudes toward sexual expression within marriage, which they held to be part of the natural blessings and expectations of God. Although Puritan society faced many challenges, during the 17th century it was characterized by stability, hierarchy, and a strong emphasis on achieving consensus. The descendants of the Puritans with whom Joseph Smith came in contact during the 19th century had changed in many ways, both theologically and socially, from their forebears. Beginning in the late 17th century, the intensity of Puritan religious commitment had begun to wane. This was true in other groups as well. And by the time of the American Revolution, church membership in the American colonies as a whole had dropped to between 5% and 8%, the lowest level in American history. In addition, by the aftermath of the American Revolution, the rate of premarital pregnancies in America had climbed from earlier relatively low figures to over 25% of the firstborn children, suggesting a breakdown of previous forms of social control. Following the American Revolution, religious groups concerned about the weakness of the churches in America began a concerted evangelical campaign against what they called religious infidelity. new or relatively new revivalistic techniques, including dramatic preaching styles, mass meetings, and exhortations to total commitment, were pioneered to bring in new members and money. The Calvinistic emphasis on human depravity and helplessness, when contrasted with a distant and all-powerful God, gave way increasingly to a more optimistic Arminian view, which stressed the active role that individuals could play in achieving their own salvation. With regard to family ideals and practices, the evangelical counterthrust also had a profound impact. Revivalists initially were primarily concerned with specifically religious issues, but eventually many individuals began to apply religious principles to pressing social problems as well. Using arguments similar to those of the revivalists, temperance crusaders denounced the drinking of alcohol as a sin and stressed the devastating effects of drink on family life. Criticizing the widespread experimentation and uncertainty in family and sexual matters in the 1830s and 1840s, ministers and secular reformers alike by the 1850s were advocating more restrictive attitudes toward sexual relations, even within marriage. This developing Victorian ethos, with its cult of true womanhood, stress on domesticity, and sentimentalized view of the family, placed enormous, even cosmic importance, emphasis on the importance of the home. The home, for many, became a retreat from the unbridled competition of the rapidly developing capitalistic society outside, a way of preserving cooperative values in the face of what was felt to be excessive individualism. Writers such as Horace Bushnell in his Christian Nurture, Catherine Beecher in her treatise on domestic economy, and innumerable others, all in their various ways, stressed that the home and the nuclear family could play an essential part in holding society together in an age of increasing fragmentation. Hymns and sermons further emphasized such themes, using explicitly religious metaphors. On the extreme fringe of the evangelical movement of the antebellum years stood a number of restorationist groups which looked toward the literal establishment of the kingdom of heaven on earth. Some of these groups, such as the Shakers, who practiced celibacy, the Oneida Perfectionists, who engaged in complex marriage, and the Mormons, who eventually introduced a form of polygamy, were dissatisfied with certain aspects of the antebellum emphasis on the nuclear family. Given the pervasiveness of that emphasis on the nuclear family, how did these groups justify their departure from the practices of the larger society? In particular, what was the relationship between Mormon theological attitudes toward the family and those of their more conventional contemporaries? All three groups argued that they were not rejecting the family ideal itself, but raising that ideal to a higher level. An expanded family and a more broadly based communal loyalty would prove superior to the narrow nuclear family union. This argument was used even by the celibate Shakers, who by the 1830s had established some 60 semi-monastic communities stretching from Maine to Indiana. Interpreting the New Testament passage that in the resurrection they neither marry nor are given in marriage to mean that the afterlife was celibate, the Shakers attempted to realize what they took to be that heavenly model on earth. Yet they still stressed that they considered their communities families, and they governed those communities under an hierarchical and oligarchic family-style paternalism. Each Shaker communal group was called a family. Individual Shakers referred to each other as brother and sister, and especially beloved adult members were addressed as father and mother. Family imagery is particularly pronounced in Shaker hymns, which speak over and over again of the love of their foundress, Mother Ann Lee, for her loyal children, and of her children's love for mother and for each other. Even more than the revivalistic songs of the larger society, Shaker hymns convey a sense of childlike simplicity, delight, and yearning for unity. Only the sexual and individualistic attachments of normal family life were eliminated so that total loyalty could be devoted to their community and to God. The Oneida Perfectionists, who established their chief community in central New York State in the late 1840s with a system of complex or group marriage, dealt even more skillfully and explicitly than did the Shakers with the problem of how ideal family relations were to be realized. John Humphrey Noyes, the founder of the Oneida community, described it over and over again as an enlarged family, and he vehemently rejected the claim that he was breaking the family apart. Rather, he declared that he was securing for all individuals in the community the benefits of a larger group. Noyes argued, in contrast to the Shakers, that while monogamous marriage would not exist in the afterlife, sex would. The saints would all love each other equally, and this would include expression of sexual love between men and women as well. At Oneida, therefore, where an attempt was made to realize this heavenly pattern on earth, each was married to all in a complex marriage. In the words of the community hymn, they all had one home and one family relation. The entire community lived under one roof in the large, sprawling mansion house. They joined in the daily religious and business meetings at which Noyes often delivered his didactic home talks. And they participated in the full range of communal work, rather as though they were living under a feudal manorial system. Only the exclusive sexual, emotional, and economic attachments of the nuclear family were eliminated in favor of a more inclusive loyalty to the community and to God. How did Mormon attitudes toward the family compare with those of other restorationist groups or with the ideals developing in Victorian America? In the 1830s, as Klaus Hansen has suggested in his provocative analysis in Mormonism and the American Experience, the Latter-day Saints initially appear to have looked back primarily toward earlier, more traditional approaches to the family, such as those of the Puritans. On the one hand, Joseph Smith, like the Puritans, rejected celibacy. In his revelation to the Shakers in March 1831, Smith sharply criticized them, both because of their celibacy and because they were founded by a woman. On the other hand, early Mormons appear, like the Puritans, to have accepted the idea of sex within marriage as a good thing, a part of the natural blessings and expectations of God. While records of early Mormon attitudes on this point are scarce, there is little evidence that Mormons of the 1830s or even considerably later accepted the nascent Victorian notions that even within marriage, sexual relations should be strictly limited. Finally, like the Puritans, early Mormons were strict in punishing lapses against conventional sexual morality, at least as far as we can tell, and they included excommunication of unrepentant offenders. Yet they viewed such sins only as one among a number of sins, rather than as a uniquely dangerous threat to purity, as the Victorians would later. In short, the Mormons of the 1830s gave little public indication that their family and sexual ideals differed significantly from those of their Puritan forebears. The chief factors that would lead the Mormons of the following decade, the 1840s, toward a new family theology and unorthodox family practices grew out of their combination of intense biblicism and their millennial commitment to establishing the kingdom of heaven on earth. Early Mormons, like the early Puritans, looked back toward Old Testament Hebrew models for many of their family ideals and considered themselves, in some sense, literally a new Israel, replicating earlier Hebrew tribal practices. Like many of his 19th century contemporaries as well, Joseph Smith immersed himself in the Bible and conceived of the whole of human history within the context established by the biblical record. Yet Smith and the early Mormons went beyond conventional biblicism, either of the Puritans or of their own day. The Book of Mormon, for example, purported to be a continuation of Scripture, and Smith, through his continuing revelations, claimed that the direct influx of the divine into human history had not ceased with New Testament days. As Smith reflected on the lives of the Hebrew patriarchs whom he admired so much, he could hardly have helped but wonder why the Lord apparently approbated their taking of plural wives. If the millennial dispensation was to be a restoration of all things, a synthesis of all previously valid human truth, might it not also include a restoration of polygamous marriage? These and other family-related concerns had remained in the background during most of the 1830s as the Latter-day Saints attempted to establish their religious faith on a firm foundation. During the early 1840s in Nauvoo, Illinois, however, family and kinship concerns came to the fore as the Mormons increasingly devoted themselves to the effort to establish their political kingdom of God, an autonomous, self-sufficient organization which they expected to govern the world during the millennium. The period between 1839 and 1844 that the Latter-day Saints spent in Nauvoo, Illinois, under Joseph Smith's leadership, proved to be pivotal to their history in almost every respect. including the development of a new family theology. Nauvoo saw the climax of an earlier phase of Mormon development and set the pattern of new doctrinal, social, and political approaches which would be further developed and tested in Utah. From one perspective, Nauvoo was a typical Jacksonian boomtown, representative of the raw potentiality, enthusiasm, crassness, and tensions that characterized the era. Yet at a more fundamental level, the Mormons in Nauvoo were attacking and attempting to overcome the rampant exploitative individualism which surrounded them. They were seeking a total solution, more akin to medieval ideals, in which religious and social life were inextricably intertwined and the good of the community took precedence over individual self-interest. Mundane secular life would be resacralized and integrated into a new organic unity, which in turn had its place and meaning in the cosmic order. During this period, Smith moved vigorously to present new doctrines that had long been germinating in his mind, doctrines designed to reestablish social cohesion not only on Earth, but also throughout all eternity. Basic to these new doctrines was an elaboration of church authority through ceremonies viewed as indissolubly linking the living and the dead. Smith claimed the keys of St. Peter with the power to bind and to loose, both on earth and in heaven. This was the basis for the doctrine of baptism for the dead, which was designed to allow dead relatives to accept the Mormon gospel in the afterlife. The material and spiritual worlds were described as indissolubly linked. God was seen in anthropomorphic terms. Once a man, he had progressed to godhood, as man could too, and obviously by extension, women. The capstone of these new doctrines were special marriage sealing ceremonies designed to give permanence to earthly marriage after death. In contrast to Shaker or Oneida perfectionist doctrine, Mormon modern revelation declared that while no marriages would be performed in heaven, marriage and the social cohesion provided by family and kinship ties would be the basis for all growth and progression in the afterlife. And I'm probably simplifying a bit here. Earthly marriage itself was an ephemeral state. Unless marriages were properly sealed by the Mormon priesthood on earth in the light of eternity, they would not continue. Those who were not married for eternity would be the lowest class in the afterlife, solitary ministering angels, a sort of perpetual servant class, unable to progress further. I can point out this may be a bit of an exaggeration. Sealings for eternity, on the other hand, made possible progression toward godhood as men became great patriarchs who ruled over an ever-increasing posterity and moved on, in the 19th century view at least, to settle whole new worlds. There was a sense of the awesome power of sexuality and procreation in human development. I hope people will bear with me that I'm simplifying rather drastically on this theology here. Most controversial, Smith revealed that polygamous marriage was a particularly exalted form of eternal or celestial marriage. If marriage with one wife, sealed under the authority of the priesthood, could bring ultimate godhood for men, then having more than one wife merely accelerated the process, in line with God's promise to Abraham that his seed eventually would become as numerous as the stars in the sky or the sands in the seashore. Furthermore, polygamy made possible the reuniting of all family members around their patriarchal leaders in the afterlife. Even if a man had lost a wife and remarried, those wives would be his again after he died. Though the revelation on plural and celestial marriage said little about exactly how polygamy was to be practiced, it repeatedly stressed that any unauthorized liaisons established outside the bounds of churchly supervised law were heinously sinful and required drastic measures for atonement. Once again, total loyalty to the church was put forward as the supreme principle. These Nauvoo doctrines, taken individually or as a whole, represented a sharp departure from normative Judaic and Christian belief. Yet Latter-day Saint concepts such as the close linkage of matter and spirit, an anthropomorphic God with a plurality of other originally human gods progressing toward the achievement of similar divinity, baptism for the dead, and above all, an afterlife in which the relationships of this life could continue in some literal sense, had much potential appeal in the 19th century. Rather than combing the past for possible but inconclusive earlier parallels to these Nauvoo doctrines, I want here to focus on the reasons for the appeal of the new beliefs and the extent to which, in the words of the Millennial Star in 1852, they could meet the needs of the human family. In a religion such as that of the Latter-day Saints, which has such a pragmatic orientation, final evaluation of a particular theological conception of the family and what it can contribute must, I believe, be by its fruits. In making such an evaluation, it is important to keep in mind the distinction between a basic principle, which may be viewed by believers as eternal, and the specific and often highly variable ways in which that principle may be realized in practice. The underlying principle, I believe, behind the Nauvoo doctrines was the effort to achieve cohesion by strengthening and extending kinship ties and loyalties. But the precise ways in which such increased cohesion could be achieved varied greatly. For example, both Joseph Smith and Brigham Young, as well as the RLDS and Strangite Mormons, attempted at different times to set up orders of Enoch or United Orders. Yet, in each case, they backed off from such efforts when those efforts failed to strengthen the group as had been hoped. And they chose other ways to try and realize the principle in practice. Similarly, during the exodus to Utah, Brigham Young attempted to introduce a form of the law of adoption in which all Mormon men would ultimately be sealed to the leaders of the church and each other, thereby linking all members together in an enlarged family. In practice, however, the adoptionary system contributed to jealousy and tension rather than unity, so it was largely abandoned by the late 1840s. Keeping in mind this distinction between principle and practice, let us look at the strengths and weaknesses of the Mormon emphasis on the importance of the family. For a group which, in the 19th century, was heavily persecuted, moved frequently, and could not rely fully on normal legal channels for redress of grievances, family and kinship ties could provide an essential source of strength and cohesion. The tribal sense of being a chosen people, a new Israel, gave a feeling of special pride and commitment, and the belief that valued earthly relationships could be eternal was a comfort in the face of long absences of missionary husbands and the struggles, sickness, and death that were experienced by so many Mormons. Plural marriage, both in theory and in practice, could further extend such loyalties. As only one rather extreme example, by his death at age 88, the Mormon patriarch Benjamin F. Johnson was related by blood or by marriage to over 800 people. Furthermore, marriage, plural or otherwise, provided experience in cooperative action and subordination of individual desires to larger group goals, which could carry over into the cooperative Mormon effort to achieve rapid settlement and development of the Intermountain West. As Leonard Arrington has observed, initially only a high degree of religious devotion and discipline, superb organization and planning made survival possible. Mormon family experiences and commitment to a family model played an essential role in this larger settlement effort. Yet there were problems with the Mormon family system, especially with polygamy. Although the Latter-day Saints, like the Shakers and Oneida Perfectionists, found that their divergence from conventional monogamous belief and practice could be useful as a means of developing group cohesion and sifting out the faint-hearted, in the long run, all three groups found that their unorthodox family systems contributed to severe internal and external tensions. As the largest and most aggressive of the three movements, the Latter-day Saints were seen as a serious threat to accepted family patterns by the larger society and were the most heavily persecuted. In addition, although the evidence has not yet been fully explored, there also appears to have been a strong undercurrent of unhappiness with plural marriage among many church members. A combination of external pressure and internal tensions ultimately combined to result in the issuance of the Manifesto of 1890, which withdrew sanction for any further plural marriages in the United States. Today, there are several paradoxes in the Mormon concept and practice of family life that continue to create tensions for the devout. The fact that plural marriage is still viewed as an eternally valid principle, yet in practice is strictly discouraged, causes intellectual confusion and uncertainty for some devoted Latter-day Saints. More far-reaching and less understood by average church members is the important shift that appears to have taken place in Mormon family and sexual attitudes, especially since World War II. 19th century Mormonism, under leaders such as Joseph Smith and Brigham Young, was heavily influenced by pragmatic Puritan notions of the conduct of family and sexual relations, and was critical of the gush and hypersentimentality of Victorianism, although it did have that element in it as well. Brigham Young's support of the functional bloomer-style Deseret costume, his criticism of sentimentalized Victorian novels as trash, and his forthrightness in dealing bluntly and directly in public with family and sexual issues that polite Victorian society thought should be kept strictly private if discussed at all, were characteristic of the approaches of many other early church leaders. By contrast, today, as I see it at least, popular church literature and exhortations appear, if anything, to be more Victorian than the Victorians. All too often, it seems to me, the images that are held up for emulation are those of pasteboard saints, supermen and superwomen whose blemishes as well as their humanity are blotted out. There are important exceptions to this tendency, such as the superb recent biography of President Spencer W. Kimball, but much more remains to be done to develop realistic and appealing models of what family life can and should be. In short, the intense Mormon emphasis on the family has both strengths and weaknesses. Whenever overriding importance is given to any human institution, whether family, state, or even church, there is always the danger of idolatry, of worshiping that institution and losing sight of the God who stands above and beyond all human institutions and whose mystery is ultimately beyond direct human comprehension. Edmund Morgan's classic study, The Puritan Family, concludes with a cautionary chapter on Puritan tribalism, which suggests some insights that may apply to the Latter-day Saints as well. Morgan begins the chapter by stressing the overriding importance that the family had for 17th century New England Puritans. The family metaphor seems to have dominated Puritan thought so completely as to suggest that the Puritans' religious experience in some way duplicated their domestic experience. Indeed, the Puritans almost tended to domesticate the Almighty. Puritans, of course, thought of their God as the one God of the universe, but they made him so much their own in the guise of making themselves his that eventually and at times he took on the character of a tribal deity. Morgan observes that as the 17th century progressed, the New England Puritans began to lose sight of the original errand into the wilderness that had brought them to the New World to set up a city upon a hill. Instead, they increasingly turned inward and developed a defensive tribal attitude. Morgan concludes, the Puritans had, in fact, committed the very sin that they had so often admonished themselves to avoid. They had allowed their children to usurp a higher place than God in their affections. When theology became the handmaid of genealogy, Puritanism no longer deserved its name. Do Morgan's observations about New England Puritan attitudes have anything to say to Mormons today? Certainly the comparison is not an exact one. Lack of evangelical zeal, for example, is definitely not a problem in either of the main branches of the Latter-day Saint movement at present. But in more Do Morgan's observations about New England Puritan attitudes have anything to say to Mormons today? Certainly the comparison is not an exact one. Lack of evangelical zeal, for example, is definitely not a problem in either of the main branches of the Latter-day Saint movement at present. But in more subtle ways, Morgan's analysis causes us to reflect on disturbing tendencies within Mormonism toward idolatry and insularity. The Mormon Church, more than many other religious movements, has made God literally theirs. Often it has been all too easy in Mormonism to assume that the specific, limited, earthly practices of the saints, developing originally because of pragmatic, earthly reasons, were really divinely ordained and immutable, rather than being the subject of progressive change due to continuing revelation or insight. With regard to the family, for example, it seems possible that by focusing on certain specific and limited present-day family patterns as though they were fixed and eternal truth. Mormons may, in fact, sometimes lose sight of the larger concept of the family and its importance that underlies their faith, and perhaps which is an enlarged family here, not simply a nuclear family. Particularly as the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints reaches outward across the world in an attempt to become a truly universal church rather than an intermountain American sect, a progressive openness to truth, wherever it may be found, will be essential. Principles may be eternal, but their application must always be flexible and open to new insight. In conclusion, let me turn to another statement by Brigham Young, which eloquently captures the sense of mystery and awe, which I believe lies at the heart of the Mormon concern with the family. Young declared, "The whole subject of the marriage relationship is not within my reach or in any other man's reach on this earth. It is without the beginning of days or the end of years. It is a hard matter to reach. We can feel some things with regard to it. It lays the foundation for worlds, for angels, and for gods, for intelligent beings to be crowned with glory, immortality, and eternal lives. In fact, it is the thread which runs from the beginning to the end of the holy gospel of the Son of God. It is from eternity to eternity." Surely the concept of the family lies at the heart of the Mormon faith and will continue to grow and develop as the faith itself continues to reach outward in new directions. Thank you.
It has been my great pain and my great pleasure during the last 2 years to work with the family in therapy. A large, strong LDS family. That is, they're very active and they believe absolutely in all the tenets of the church. I first started working with them when their teenage daughter, the youngest child, was repeatedly suicidal. And she was brought in because they didn't know how to deal with her anymore. And as I worked with her over the next number of months, trying to control those suicide attempts and trying to understand why that was happening, I came to realize that the central dilemma that she dealt with in her life about why she wanted to die and maybe why she wanted to live was probably the same dilemma that many other people in that family were living with. The dilemma that she was living with was, if I am not perfect enough, is life worth it? If I am not living up to what my family wants me to live all of the rules of the church and to get married, she was worrying about this at 17, and to get married and to have children, which I don't know will ever happen, are we even a family? Am I even a part of this family? Do I even deserve to be alive? And that concerned me enough that I asked the parents to come in, and then a few weeks later asked the entire family to come in. Amazingly enough, all 11 adult members came, including spouses, and we've then followed with a series of interviews. During the second session, at which, interestingly enough, this teenage daughter never spoke, but everyone else did, and they fought marvelously, and they loved marvelously, and they said what they liked about each other, and they also said what they couldn't stand. One daughter-in-law, who was Catholic, who had married one son who had left the church and converted to Catholicism, looked at her mother-in-law and said, "We have never talked. I have never been a part of your family. I don't know if I can be. You are so concerned that you have lost me in the next life that I haven't yet had a relationship with you in this life." They're still talking, and they still haven't made it, and the daughter is still suicidal every once in a while, and the father is now unemployed, and yet I believe they're still a strong Mormon family. They have some incredible strengths. Unfortunately, their weaknesses are more visible than most Mormon families, so we might call them weak. But I believe that the dilemma that they struggle with every day is, are we a family if everyone is not doing what the church says that it should do? Are we really a family? Is the dilemma that many other people within the church struggle with. And I am thanking Larry and his presentation for talking about that idea, that for all of the strengths that are there present in the church, that there are also weaknesses. Every utopian thought has its dark side. And I understand the process of utopian thought, having engaged in a lot of it in my life. It's wonderful to be having that euphoric zeal, to be working toward an ideal. And I believe, in fact, that one of the rational reasons for romance is that it gives us the zeal and the sense of motivation to work through the pain and struggle that every relationship requires. So I wouldn't do away with, for a minute, with the sense of goals, with the sense of a heaven to achieve, and a sense of family. I would like to center my remarks today around augmenting Larry's comments about the strengths and weaknesses of the Mormon family and doing it as quickly as possible. I think one of his major contributions, like I said, was that he talked about weaknesses being in Mormon families as well as strengths. The strengths that I perceive as being readily sensed are that most Mormon families, and I suggest that the church can be seen as a metaphor for family as well as the church's families, that the church has, as a whole, and families within the church, have a larger sense of family. We can go to almost anywhere in the church and have family functions performed for you at a drop of a hat. Now, it may not be done with the same kind of sensitivity that's done in your own family. Sometimes it's done with more sensitivity than it's done in your own family. There's also a sense of continuity. I have grown up with a sense that I really ultimately belong to everyone else, and that I would forever and ever. And a fellow therapist who was non-Mormon once asked me, why is it that Mormons hang so tenaciously on to each other? I mean, you know, you stay in this system and you never let go. And I said, what will happen as you grow older and all of your friends start to die? And he looked and he says, I don't want to give those up. And I said, that's one of the holes. We never have to say goodbye. Fourth, I believe that from the evidence that I've seen, the research evidence that I've seen, that children benefit greatly within the Mormon system. Two pieces very quickly. One of them is that children quickly attain a level of morality, moral reasoning, moral thinking, moral behavior, quickly attain that at a very young age as compared to us and other religious systems. There was a study done about 4 years ago comparing Protestant, Catholic, and Mormon families with Kohlberg's scheme of six stages of moral reasoning. Mormon children attained the fourth stage, which was conventional morality, at the age of about 8 or 9, and seemed to stay that way the rest of life. That was also in other words, adults had the same level as what those children had. Whereas Catholic and Protestant families in this study took longer to achieve that level of morality, but they also maintained that same level, which may say something about religion, or it may say something about Kohler's scheme. The fourth is that for those marriages who are contracted and are lived as the church guides or says, in terms of the specific practices of getting married in the temple, having the husband as the breadwinner, having X number of children, and so on and so on. Generally, the research evidence is that they rate themselves very, very happy, and that they are stable. Temple marriages is somehow 8 to 10 times more durable than civil marriages that are contracted. Oh, by the way, the second piece of evidence about children is one piece of research that was done a couple of years ago by Marge Pett here in Salt Lake City on single parent families, and she found Mormon families compared to non-Mormon families in the area, that for those divorcing Mormon families, that the children of the divorced families came through very well, that they, more than the other religious groups, had a sense of stability and belonging to a group. That was not true of the parents, however. Which brings us to the weaknesses. I have several questions to ask in terms of highlighting these weaknesses. One of them is a central question that if you do not follow the practices that are specifically outlined by the church, can you call yourself a family? In my own experience as a single parent, I have often run across the terms intact and broken, that intact families are those that are nuclear families with husband and wife and children, and that broken families are any other form that are not. But my own personal experience is that I felt more broken when I was married and I felt more intact now that I am single with my children and have a strong sense of being family. In fact, my sense of intactness, I think, comes with how I'm related to them, how well I'm getting along with them, and how well we're meeting each other's needs. And the brokenness is how insensitive or how much we are not paying attention to each other. And sometimes that varies on a day-to-day basis, sometimes many times in the same day. So can we even be a family if we don't follow the church rules is a central question, I think, that a lot of people struggle with, which disenfranchises many times people who are single or divorced, who have never been married for whatever reason, who are childless. Heaven forbid if you make a choice to be childless. So in some sense, I wonder, does the church serve the family or does the family serve the church? If the church sets up all of the descriptions about what a family can and cannot be and has all of its ordinances lined up so that they must do those in order to be a family, is the family serving the church or the church serve the family? I don't know that the question can be answered. Clearly, because they are so much in each other's pocket, probably both is true. The church does serve the families in many ways, in areas of strength, and in many times, however, the family is clearly serving the church. Maureen Beecher suggested the question to me that in what ways do they not serve each other, but we don't have time to look at that. Secondly, the worship of the family seems to me to create at least three effects, the worship of the family that Larry suggested. One of them is that only one form is accepted, all the others are not accepted. Secondly, it creates an atmosphere of not being able to question the practices or the church, and so we question ourselves. I've heard so many families talk about successful families be those families where the kids where there's a temple marriage, the kids grow up, go to school, go on missions, get married in the temple, and it's a wonderful, lovely family. And if that doesn't happen, there are a number of families who are in my parents' age group who are saying, what did we do wrong? How did we fail them as parents? How did we fail as a family because they didn't get married in the temple or because they're not extremely active in the church? And I'm suggesting that maybe we always shouldn't turn the question back on ourselves. We should look at both sides of the issue, that there may be some church practices that, in fact, are not serving the family well. Thirdly, I believe by having a narrow sense of what families are, that many times we lose sight of the larger family that we all belong to. And I mean beyond just the larger family of the church, but also the larger family of humanity, that in a real sense, we are all connected in an inextricable way. And the family of man is more than just a metaphor. This brings us to the implications, which I think Larry also suggested. And I loved his statement that said he believes that we should have a progressive openness to form due to insight and revelation based on principles rather than on practices. He didn't know that that happens to be one of my soapboxes, and so I was glad to have it delivered here today. I think that that is a place or a key concept to start to solve the dilemmas and look to the future. And since I'm already at the time, I will quickly run through the rest of what I have to say in a nutshell, I hope. Assuming some current conditions in the church, increased growth, continuous a single population that now exists of about 30%, continued worldwide growth of many cultures, and continuing high divorce rate. It's increasing not to the degree that the rest of the American public's rate is increasing, but it is increasing nonetheless with the same kind of scale. Given all of those kinds of conditions, what kinds of forms of family are acceptable within the Mormon theological framework, based upon principles rather than practice? I wish I had time to say so, but I think some of the two basic principles in which a family to be a family needs to be organized around is truly loving and caring about each other, where each person's needs are as important as the others, and secondly, a sense of order, that there is a sense of predictability and a sense of control about one's life. As I look forward to that, I think that there are many forms possible. I think all the ones that we have currently talked about, monogamous, polygamous, extended family, I believe that single parent, double parent, childless families, all are families. And an interesting idea that was suggested to me by a good friend of mine is that those friendships that we have in our lives also have a strong sense of family. That the metaphors that we use are family metaphors. We are related. I have a friend who's sitting here in the audience who... somebody said, "You two look like sisters and act like sisters," and she said, "We have the same heavenly mother." We also many times use the metaphor of having known each other in the pre-existence. As Emmeline Wells said in the later part of her life, talking about her sister wives, "We were closer than sisters, and I recall those whom I loved as much as if bound by kindred ties, closer perhaps because our faith and work were so in tune with our everyday life." And I ran onto an interesting scripture that seems to me to indicate that there may be possibilities for the same kind of binding and sealing of friendship as there are for marriages and creating a sense of family for us all. In the Doctrine and Covenants 88:133, it reads, "This was the time of the school of the prophets, and this was a greeting that the men gave to each other as they entered." And I'm assuming as I read it that one could also substitute sister where it reads brother. "Art thou a brother or brethren? I salute you in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ, in token or remembrance of the everlasting covenant, in which covenant I receive you to fellowship, any determination that is fixed, immovable, and unchangeable, to be your friend and brother, through the grace of God and the bonds of love, to walk in all the commandments of God blameless in thanksgiving forever and ever. Amen." I have seen all forms of the family, whether it's organized around the ones I mentioned or whether it's organized around patriarchal, matriarchal, egalitarian, democratic, or whatever mixture, work. I have seen all of them not work. It all seems to function around whether they're living some basic principles, I think, of love and order. I would like to suggest that the new and everlasting covenant, the sense that we're all sealed and bound together forever, may cast a wider net over more people than we had previously thought of. I don't know that that's a new idea necessarily, but the geography of heaven may be much more interesting than we previously thought. My recommendation is to let people accept their circumstances as they are and to create their own sense of family by concentrating on the principles that really creates the eternal bonds between people, not by commandment or constraint, but by revelation and word of wisdom. I cannot emphasize how strongly I feel that form is secondary to principle. The process of how we live our lives is more important than the circumstances in which we live. And I believe if we do that, that Brigham Young's vision will be more than metaphor, and we will all indeed feel now in this life, as well as in the earth to come, in the heaven to come, that we are all one family. Thank you.
I guess we're over time, so I guess we're going to have to call it quits. I'll make one brief commercial. If anyone's interested in my book, I have some forms that will give it to you freer, at less cost.